And I'm going to start out today with our first speaker, Dr. Michael Olnick. He's a professor of educational policy studies and sociology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and he's a faculty associate in the Wisconsin Center for Education Research and the Institute for Research on Poverty. His BA is from Columbia University, and his master's and doctorate are from Harvard. Following the completion of his bachelor's degree, I noticed on his CV he was a high school history teacher for 1 year. He's published approximately 20 articles and book chapters on topics like immigrants in education, multiculturalism in American education, high school completion and men's income, the effects of birth order and family size on achievement. He's also published several other reports and institute papers. He serves on several professional boards, and he teaches a range of courses here on the Madison campus. Now, Professor Olnick has graciously contributed a lot of time in helping plan this seminar, and as a result, I've learned a lot from him about educational policy. My own area of research is adolescent development, and I didn't quite honestly expect to learn about theories of adolescent development from Professor Olnick, but in one of our conversations, he mentioned that he has this theory of adolescent development, and he said it is that you should have your children later in life, and then when they become teenagers, you're senile, and you don't really care what they do at all. So, you want the car tonight? He said, great, I can't drive anymore anyway, that'd be fine. So he tells me that he and his wife have a son. Benjamin is only 4. So we're going to have to wait a couple years to test out this theory to see if it really holds water. So let me welcome Professor Olnick. He's not going to be talking about adolescent development today. Instead, he's going to be discussing factors that affect academic achievement.
Ben understands the education system. He is resisting going to kindergarten next year on the grounds that, quote, I don't want to have to be somewhere at a certain time. He understands. Anyway, good morning. Lynn Magdal's chapter in your seminar briefing book reviews the factors that influence academic achievement. These include the measurable resources allocated to schools, the content and form of the curriculum, the characteristics of students, and the practices of teachers. Your task of figuring out how state policy can usefully influence these factors is a very difficult one. This is true for at least 2 reasons, and I'm sure you could add many, many more. First, the immediate outputs of state policy are remote from the point at which instruction and learning occur. For example, mandating achievement standards does not automatically ensure that teachers will know how to teach in ways that meeting the standards require, or that they will teach in circumstances that permit or encourage them to teach in ways that new standards demand. Neither, by way of another example, does allocating funds to local districts to permit appreciable reductions in class size ensure that teachers will change how they teach to take full advantage of significantly smaller classes. This means that to be effective, policy design must take into account and be responsive to the manner in which resources or mandates from a distant level are translated into outputs at subsequent levels or activity through to the point of teaching and learning within the classroom. Jim Spillane's research illustrates this point well, and he'll be discussing it in a while. Second, factors of production in education do not act independently of one another. They cannot simply be added to one another, or do they simply add up in their effects. Rather, they combine in complex ways that create intricate contexts of teaching and learning. This means that policy, which by its very nature tends to be broadly applicable and uniform, must somehow be designed to take into account and be responsive to the particular characteristics of individual districts, schools, and classrooms. One such particularity is the costs associated with producing any given level of achievement, and Andy Reshofsky will be addressing this question soon. With these 2 general points in mind, I want to make some specific observations that link a small portion of what we know about what influences students' achievements to the challenge of finding effective policies that can help raise and equalize achievement. I will address goal, differences in achievement among students who attend the same school, the effects of students' background characteristics, the importance of specific skill training, the formation of learning communities among teachers, and parents' involvement in their children's educations. While differences among schools do affect achievement, by far the greatest proportion of variation in achievement arises among students who attend the same schools. As important as it is to offer equal opportunities to students who attend different schools, it is at least as important to offer equal opportunities to students who attend the same school. For example, the ability groups or tracks into which a student is placed have a substantial impact on achievement. Students placed in lower tracks gain appreciably less than comparable students who are placed in more favorable groups or tracks, and thus fall increasingly behind their peers in the higher groups or tracks. When tracking is accompanied by a commitment to challenging curriculum, on the other hand, it can facilitate learning on the part of lower track students. While this is not a problem that is readily amenable to state policy, or properly necessarily addressed directly by state policy, we can imagine ways in which states could promote a broader commitment to challenging curriculum for all. This might be accomplished through state curriculum frameworks and state-of-the-art standards applicable to the teaching and assessment of all. However, even when students are placed in ostensibly the same learning environments, considerable variations in achievement emerge, including persistent, systematic disparities associated with socioeconomic background and race, to which I now turn. We often talk about the effects of students' poverty status, race, family structure, native language, and such, as if these effects were simple extrapolations of the students themselves, which the schools have had no hand in producing, and which they can at best compensate for. This is not, however, the whole picture. What the schools do or fail to do in the face of such variations among students may contribute to the very effects we attribute exclusively to the students themselves. For example, if we discover that students whose native dialect is Black vernacular English have serious difficulties in decoding what teachers are saying, we are prone to say that the students' use of Black English causes their difficulties in learning, rather than to conclude that the school's sole reliance on standard English is implicated as well. Such reliance, particularly where it is accompanied by sanctions on students' native ways of speaking, may produce not only difficulties in comprehension, but also resistance to schooling. It is vital that we recognize that for some students of color, whose perspectives for very understandable reasons are not those of immigrants, we must ensure that schooling is legitimate as well as comprehensible. To these ends, various models of multicultural, culturally relevant, and culturally responsive teaching have been identified as effective in promoting academic success among students of color, while at the same time permitting them to remain true to their ethnic identities and cultures. My colleague Gloria Lassen-Billings, for example, in her recent book, The Dream Keepers, details the practices of teachers who have enjoyed unusual success in teaching African American students. I will leave it to the discussion on improving teacher practice, which some of you will be engaged in later, to consider what role the state could or should have in advancing the dissemination and implementation of such models. At the same time that we recognize the importance of culturally responsive teaching, we should nevertheless not ignore the specific skill needs, that must be met if students are to be able to participate in what the African-American educator Lisa Delpit calls the culture of power. These include command of standard English, as well as of mainstream modes of self-presentation and interaction. We do not need to resort to the vocabulary of cultural deficiency to recognize that some groups of students depend more upon the schools to impart these skills than do others. In this vein, recent findings from Dallas, Texas are significant. In this study, difficulties that young poor students of color had following their teachers' speech patterns completely accounted for their lower reading skills. Lower reading skills, in turn, almost fully accounted for racial gaps in social studies coursework mastery among 7th and 8th graders. In response to these findings, the study's author recommends early explicit reading instruction as being critical. To that end, the author himself established an extensive program of sustained, frequent, one-on-one tutoring in the primary grades of Dallas by trained, underline trained, college students. The program demonstrated strong, measurable impact on primary school students' reading skills. Providing resources for such special projects may well fall within the purview of state policy. The findings from the Dallas study are consistent with recent national findings that Head Start and Title I programs have, in fact, on average, contributed positively to the academic achievement of disadvantaged youths. And they should caution against pessimism and cynicism regarding the value of well-funded, carefully implemented educational interventions. It is in vogue within academic research circles to encourage the formation of what are called learning communities within classrooms. The term learning community refers to the creation of a social group of mutually supportive learners who devote themselves to accomplishing particular learning tasks and goals. Recent findings from District 2 in New York City suggest that organized learning communities among teachers under the guidance of more activist principals can contribute to dramatic increases in academic achievement among students. Through various forms of collaborative learning among the teachers, mutual support, and organized interaction with educators beyond their immediate schools, District 2's teachers were both invigorated and acquired greater proficiency in their craft. Dissemination of and support for the emulation of District 2's model of teacher learning might well be an appropriate function of the state. The occurrence of today's seminar within a series of seminars concerning the intersections of policy and families attests to the significance of the family's role in education. This is a role that research strongly supports. Even when students share socioeconomic or racial backgrounds, growing up in one family rather than another can have powerful effects on how well students do in school and how long they stay in school. How parents exercise authority and shape the social organization of the household, what they communicate about the importance of schooling to their children's futures, how much they encourage persistence and excellence in school, the degree to which they monitor their children's schoolwork, the place they assign to reading in the household, and the involvement they have in their children's schools all do have significant effects on students' educational outcomes. Increasing parental involvement in schooling is, therefore, a valuable goal of policy, as Ann Henderson will describe shortly. Nevertheless, we need to be cautious about the extent to which our policies and practices rely on parental involvement as a means to improve academic achievement. We must recognize that the idealized model of parental involvement is based on the premises of middle-class professional lives. While middle-class professional parents may well expect and desire to be, quote, partners with the school, others may expect and prefer a sharper division of labor between home and school, based on the relative expertise of each. While middle-class professional parents may, because of their own schooling and the nature of their own work, have the skills and knowledge to be adjunct teachers, this is not true of all, And I'm informed by those of you with high school students that doing math these days is not something any of us are particularly good at when our children bring their lessons home. While middle-class professional parents might find schools to be familiar and comfortable places in which they have enjoyed success in the past and command respect in the present, this is not true for all. Precisely because of the danger of judging a child's motivation and potential in light of their parents' involvement and their parents' displays of caring, we should recognize that however desirable particular forms of parental involvement may be, they should not become prerequisites for a child's opportunities to succeed in school. We should be asking, in addition to how to increase parental involvement, what the schools might provide as substitutes when that involvement is necessarily limited. We should also recognize that not all kinds of parents have the skills, knowledge, and confidence to engage the schools as individuals. For some parents, collective action aimed at ensuring that the schools be responsive to their children's needs and organized mutual support, inquiring understanding of the curriculum, for example, may be more efficacious. The anthropologist Concha Delgado Gaitan has, for example, described an effective program in a Latino community in which a parent group studied the same language arts material that their children were studying. Through this experience, the parents were able to both help their children more and to approach and engage the school with greater confidence and familiarity. I don't have a nice tied-in ending. I hope that these brief reflections are of some value to you as you consider ways in which the policies you adopt here in Madison can enhance the academic success and life chances of children throughout the state. Thank you.
Do you have some questions for Professor Olnick?
The question is, how could research demonstrate that simply not being able to follow the patterns of teacher speech completely accounted for reading deficiencies, reading disparities among very young children? I think you're absolutely right to question whether any single factor could possibly account for all of a particular gap. I questioned that myself. Without going into the technical details of the study, I'll simply say the effort was made to compare problems with following speech patterns to the effects of other kind of problems that are sometimes imputed to the kids, like slower retrieval of information, slower processing of information, which if you translate that out of social science jargon, comes out to be they're stupider. Whereas not knowing speech patterns, not being familiar with speech patterns, is a very different thing. First of all, research is always confined to the sample it pertains to. I would never walk away and say, please don't walk away and say that crazy professor said, research shows only, you know, that what I'm saying is in that sample of primary grade kids in Dallas, once you corrected for differences in those, in the ways in which speech patterns were being apprehended, the reading skills as tested by the Iowa Test of Basic Skills were the same among white and black kids. I will answer one important caveat, which I'm glad you asked or elicited, which is this is a sample within the school district of Dallas, which means you don't have necessarily a fully representative sample of either blacks or whites, so that certainly it's cut off in terms of having representative samples of kids from the suburbs, for example. So if you put them all together, I would be, frankly, as surprised as you would be to find that one factor did it. I was using that example not to say this is the only thing. I was using that example to say there are specific identifiable skill needs that we don't have to summarize globally as cultural deficiency or, you know, some global picture of kids that can be addressed by well-tailored interventions. That's the only point I would make. And obviously, if it conveys that that's the magic bullet, then I should present it differently the next time I present it.
Other question? Yes.
The question, I believe, is given parental concerns and reservations about detracking, about heterogeneous grouping rather than separation by ability or prior achievement, given parental resistance, given the politics of the circumstance, how should the state go about addressing it? I may have to do a typically faculty kind of thing and sort of say, in some way evade, and another way say you're absolutely right, because studies of schools in desegregated settings that are detracking, that Jeannie Oakes is, for example, conducting in California, show that the politics of detracking, both from the point of view of the teachers and from the point of view of advantaged parents, are very, very tricky. I think one answer is to start small. First of all, you don't want to start anything big. And I'm speaking, I hope, informed speculation, but this is speculation. Since the teachers and the parents both have reservations, you could do two things. One is you would start small. You would train. First of all, you'd need to train teachers in how one teaches in a heterogeneous grouping setting. You don't just say, fine, tomorrow you have a different kind of configuration in the classroom. Second, you do demonstrations. I mean, you could I don't know, you know, people who know the internal politics of schools and districts better than I would tell you whether this makes any sense. But I would start small. I would try to do it, learn how to do it with a small number of kids, and then if it was working, expand. The second thing I would say, and it was the importance of snippets of research that show in some settings the lower track classes can be challenging, can be serious, can assume the kids are learners. They just have to go slower. They just have to have more help. But they are not different kinds of students in some essential sense. And I would urge, you know, I think we could probably do more for the lower track curriculum and teaching in real time than we could suddenly to detrack.
Thank you, Professor Olnick. You've given us some very important and meaty issues to chew on, but you didn't answer one question I have, and maybe I should have asked you about this before you gave the talk. You know, my younger son came home with a lower grade recently, and I was giving him a little pep talk, and he said that one of his friends told him that low grades are due in large part to heredity. You know, any evidence on that?
I want to. No. I do. I know it's a joke, but it's actually very important because teachers believe this, American adults believe this, in Japan and other Asian countries they do not believe this. They believe it's due to effort. Our kids say they're doing fine when they're not. Their kids say, "Gosh, we're not doing very well," when they're doing fine. So I think it was meant to be a joke.